You are listening to Over and Back's Basketball Mysteries of the 1970s. Today's mystery is, what happened to the Kentucky Colonels? Hi, welcome to Over and Back. I'm Jason, and my special guest today is Adam Johnson of Basketball Pantheon. Adam, welcome back to the show, sir.
How's it going, Jason? Good to be back.
So we're going to dig into the Kentucky Colonels, one of the really the most accomplished franchises in ABA history, especially if you consider regular season accomplishments. They had three of the eight best SRS seasons in ABA history. They were very first, sixth and eighth during their time there, which is pretty impressive. They actually had the most regular season wins in ABA history, which, considering the Pacers had all those really good teams and won those three championships, it's a little bit of a surprise to me, but they managed to pull that off, and they're one of the, you know, really the one of the most accomplished teams, franchises that don't exist anymore at all.
Yeah, they really are. And there was only one season of the they were you know, obviously in the ABA for all nine seasons of the ABA, and didn't move, you know, no major, you know, scandals. It was very much a stable franchise for the entire 9 years, which is, you know, basically only them and the Pacers. So yeah, very impressive. And that 72 season obviously was phenomenal until the playoffs, but yeah, the only losing season they had was the very first season. So yeah, it was a marquee franchise of that ABA for sure.
Yeah, and they did a few wacky things in their early days. I mean, remember the ABA.com, and Loose Balls has some good stuff there. But they're originally owned by Joseph and Mamie Gregory, and their mascot was Ziggy, their famous show dog who they took everywhere, had a special seat for home games, and was very much a part of their big marketing material. Apparently would go to some of the owners' meetings as well. So Ziggy was a bit of a character as far as the early days, one of those quaint promotional things that the ABA was known for.
Yeah, I guess I should have qualified to say nothing crazy in terms of ABA. Obviously,
yes.
Obviously, to the NBA, that would be a very odd thing to have a show dog that you carry around everywhere. But yeah, in terms of the ABA, no major scandals. But no, yeah, the pictures of the show dog are hilarious. It's like, I can't imagine, you know, Mark Cuban walking in with this kind of dog to some sort of owner's meeting. It'd be absolutely ridiculous. But
yes. The other kind of notable odd thing they did in, I think it was the 69 season, they had, Penny Ann Early, a female jockey. She actually appeared in a game for the Colonels, inbounded the ball, and then Kentucky immediately called a timeout or moved her from the game. Coach Gene Rhodes was not happy about the whole situation, but was forced into doing that. They got some attention for that, but that was obviously the kind of maybe the kind of attention that you don't necessarily want to do. They do say that all publicity is good publicity, but that it was a little bit of a, you know, making the game a bit of a farce just to do something that's kind of notable. That's like Continental Basketball Association level type stuff.
Right. Yeah. Pretty embarrassing. I mean, because it's one thing if it would have been like a great female basketball player of the time. It's like, oh, you give someone some shine that probably deserves it. But a jockey, it just is, yeah, completely a publicity stunt. And I can totally understand from a coach's perspective why that would anger a coach. But that's, I guess, where the ABA was in those days.
Yeah. And they did, as you mentioned, they had some success early on in the first four seasons of the ABA, and most of that was carried by Louis Dampier and Daryl Carrier, who were two early three-point pioneers. Rich coined them the original Splash Brothers. They during the first three seasons together, they combined to score more than 50 points a game, and they really were a tandem that required their opponents to really construct special defenses just to contain their long range shooting. We went through some of this in our three pointers episode, but they really were, you know, both among the early pioneers of a three pointer, and really were, you know, not shooting it in, you know, modern Steph Curry standards, but were certainly shooting it at a rate that, you know, the NBA wouldn't really reach until the early to mid 90s.
Right, and I believe Dampier led the league in three-point shooting once, and it was, I think, about 38-39%. So it's like, you know, leading the league at 39%, that's kind of sounds kind of crazy today's standards, but at the time that was pretty accurate. And yeah, he absolutely used it. He was an all-star every year of the franchise history except one. Really, really impressive from Louis Dampier. But yeah, Carrier also early on, all-star first couple years. And actually, I mean, really, that's just that starting the second season, they were a good team without any sort of big man, any sort of real help. It was really a guard dominated team. And that's pretty impressive in those early days to be able to do that without any sort of big presence.
Yeah. And the other notable thing is that they were trying to they went after a Louisville star, Wes Unseld, coming out of college. But he ended up going to the Bullets instead. And that would have been obviously an opportunity to upgrade the franchise and get, you know, one of the great big men of all time. But it didn't work out for the Colonels. However, they were able to sign another great Kentucky big man in 1971. Actually, 1970, heading into the 71 season, it was Dan Issel, who had played for the University of Kentucky and signed there before the NBA draft. Didn't really even consider the NBA. He was very much, you know, wanted to be part of the ABA, wanted to stay in Kentucky, thought the league was an exciting thing, and really was the, you know, the next foundational piece for them to have really great success for the next 5-6 seasons.
Yeah, that's the move that pretty much legitimized the franchise. And it was the same year that they moved from the Louisville Convention Center to Freedom Hall, which is kind of the legendary, you know, University of Louisville stadium that was used for years and years and years. And yeah, it was really impressive reading about Dan Issel that there really was no thought of NBA. It was like, I'm going to make this thing where I'm from great. And that's pretty impressive at that time when, you know, the pay probably would have been much better in the NBA. But that's also the same year that they changed colors. They were a green, kind of a greenish color early on, and then those last 6 years were obviously changed to what we know as kind of the red, white, and blue. But yeah, he completely legitimized the franchise, won Rookie of the Year, his rookie year, and led the league in scoring.
Yeah, actually co-Rookie of the Year with Charlie Scott. But right, yes, right, he led the right. league in with 29.9 points per game, almost 30, and was definitely, you know, considered a good shooter for his size. Great at running the floor, was versatile in being able to go between power forward and center at a time which that was really rare, and was very durable. Is actually was fifth all time in scoring for both leagues when he retired, and is 10th today. You know, he's not necessarily somebody who's thought of in those terms.
Yeah, very good player. And some of the, obviously, I think this is a big lament of this whole project, that there's not enough video of ABA action. But the little that we could see of him at that point in his career, which is pretty much his prime, he could really move for a big man. I think, you know, as you noted, in kind of inside-outside game, he's really a scorer just from kind of all over the court. And by the time they got Artis Gilmore, obviously, he was a great compliment to him on the offensive end. So, yeah, no, Dennis was a phenomenal player that probably gets slept on a little too much.
Yeah. And this season began with Mike Storen came in. He was the Indiana Pacers general manager who had built that team into the powerhouse it became. Came in and cleaned house. He fired Coach Gene Rhodes after a month, which was a very controversial move locally. Rhodes was well liked and had, you know, been fairly successful. They were actually already a pretty good team when he came in. They were 10-5 or so, and then Frank Ramsey, the great Celtics player and Kentucky star, ended up being his replacement. Took a while to find him, and he would actually commute 3 hours away from Madisonville to coach the team, with kind of the understanding that it would only be 1 year. But he was another guy who had sort of that civic duty behind him. It's like, okay, Kentucky's pro team needs me. I'll go ahead and at least do this temporarily. They were only 32-35 in the regular season under Ramsey, but then came together in the playoffs to really make a special run. For the season, they were 44-40, which was fourth in the league, and they were just under a negative SRS of 0.17, which was fourth in the league. So, you know, they weren't necessarily a team that was looking to go to the finals, but they made a surprise run to head into the finals.
Yeah, and pretty much a terrible defensive team that year. They were 10th in the league in defensive rating out of 11 teams. So it was very much, lead season charge, led by all offense. You know, obviously had the 2 3-point shooters, and now Issel to combine with them. And Cincy Powell was an all-star that year as well. But, yeah, the coaching situation was very odd. Alex Groza actually took over for two games in between Gene Rhodes and Frank Ramsey. As you talked about, Frank Ramsey had, like, kind of bent over backwards to actually coach the team. And ended up facing the Utah Stars in the finals.
Yeah, and Alex Groza is interesting. He was a guy who had, in the 50s had been banned because he'd sort of been tainted by some of, like, those, the college gambling scandals, and I believe was banned from the NBA, and then it sort of surfaced again later on in the ABA and served as coach and general manager for Kentucky, and then later on was the general manager in San Diego. So it kind of, was able to stay in basketball despite having that early, scandalous past. Other notable guys who played, Walter Simon was also on this team, and Goose Ligon, who was a good defensive player, actually was his absence in the finals would be notable. They managed to beat the Floridians 4-2 in the East semis. The Floridians had Matt Calvin and Larry Jones, who were both small, high scoring guards. Also had Ira Harge, was the top scorer for them. And the Floridians had actually won 7 straight games up to the final game of the season to barely clinch the final spot with a record of 42-42. So they were very close to the Colonels in that record. Dampier hit a clutch, a 10-foot jumper near the end of game one to seal it. And then able to take it from there. In the East finals, they won 4-2 over the Virginia Squires, who were a 55-win team, had a very good roster. Charlie Scott, as we mentioned, the co-rookie of the year. Doug Moe, who was a very good defensive forward, though was aging a bit at this point. Ray Scott, who had come over from the NBA, was a pretty solid big man, a decent outside shooter. And George Carter, who was another, a pretty good forward on that team. And then the 71 finals, they lost 4-3 to the Utah Stars. This was the year that Zemo Beatty had come to the Utah Stars, did an episode with Curtis Harris discussing that situation. And even though the Stars were heavily favored, a much better regular season team, Kentucky didn't make it easy. They gave them a tough series.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, full 7-game series. In a situation where they for sure were not the favorites. And it was, again, probably just an all offense affair. It's like Kentucky's game plan was clearly just let's outscore Utah and hope for the best. But Zemo Beatty really dominated the series.
Yeah, absolutely. And Utah won their games pretty handily, average win of 13 points, but then they lost all three of their the games on the road by an average of 4, including an overtime loss in game 4. The Stars won game 5, 137-127. In game 6 in Freedom Hall, the Stars looked like they had a 195 lead with less than 4 remaining, but then Cincy Powell hit a big shot and Louis Dampier hit a 3-point play to not the score, to tie the score at 100, and then after that the Colonels hit some free throws to go ahead, and then we're able to win game 6. But then going back to game 7, Ligon, he was hampered by a back injury and couldn't go in game 7. The year, I think he did play a little bit, but was very ineffective. But despite that, Dan Issel had 41 points, and Cincy Powell had 20 points, 19 rebounds, and they were competitive. But then Zemo Beatty had 36 points and 16 rebounds, and Willie Wise had 22 points and 20 rebounds, and the Stars were able to win at 131-121. But obviously a good effort for the Colonels, and with the youth of their team seemed to, think that they were going to be on to great things.
Yeah, definitely. There was absolutely a reason for optimism to make a sort of run like that with the coaching change midseason, a la, Cleveland this past season. But yeah, it's a weird series. It kind of reminds me, there's like, you see those random series in the East in these last 4 or 5 years where they might go 7, kind of like Philly and Boston in 2012, where it's like, obviously Boston was a better team and they dominated all their home games, but just for some reason those home games in Kentucky, the Colonels found a way to kind of pull out each one, and a lot of times it was Dan Issel just going off.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, he definitely was. I mean, he and Dampier were both very, very strong in that series. So 72, things get even better. They end up drafting Artis Gilmore. The Floridians wanted Gilmore, but they were about to fold. So the Colonels ended up winning a sealed bid auction for Gilmore. They paid him 10 years, $1.5 million contract, which include deferred payments, which were a staple of ABA contracts, which we'll get into in another episode. He was introduced famously during halftime of a game in Kentucky. They turned all the lights off and gave him this dramatic entrance under a spotlight in Kentucky, and the fans roared with the potential of having him coming in the next season. There's also a press conference at the 21 Club in New York, since Gilmore had been a fairly substantial college star. They measured him at 7'8" with his afro. Famously, he was as many players did at that time. He had the very big afro. And as a rookie, he was named first team All-ABA, Most Valuable Player, Rookie of the Year over Julius Erving, and ABA All-Rookie Team. He had almost 60% field goal percentage and 17.8 rebounds per game, 23.8 points per game. extremely dominant player and was considered to have really no offensive game yet, you know, obviously scoring almost 24 points a game in addition to the great rebounding and great defense. He was an immediate, you know, sensation in the ABA, obviously winning the MVP, and then would really be dominant in the ABA for the next five seasons, and then would have a very good NBA career as well. I recently did a basketball reference search comparing Shaquille O'Neal to Artis Gilmore and was surprised at how similar they were in a lot of respects. The one big difference is that Shaq was much more he had much heavier usage in offense and had more, you know, points per game, and you know, we could carry that burden. But, you know, if you could kind of consider some of the advantages that Gilmore had defensively, you could make a fairly solid comparison between the two.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the little video we get to see of Artis Gilmore at this time just looks like a completely different human on the court, because a lot of these ABA teams did not have giant centers like the NBA at the time, where it was just that was the game. It was pounded down low and, you know, use your big and go from there, whereas that really wasn't the case in the ABA. So to have that on your team with the backcourt that they already had was such a huge advantage. And yeah, I mean, like I was saying, in that 71 season where they went to the finals, they were 10th in defensive rating out of 11. The next year they shot up to first and stayed at first for three of the next five seasons. And the other season was they finished second. So yeah, I mean, he was just a force on the defensive end, just on his own, blocking shots. His arms were so long, could get up quick. His second jump was pretty quick. And yeah, you know, we talked about how his offense, you know, wasn't the most refined, but at the time he was so big and so powerful, just a simple drop step or a simple little post move, I mean, he just dunk on people like it was just nothing. And yeah, I mean, he was a very, very effective player, particularly that first year when, you know, obviously MVP is as a rookie, that's impressive. Led the league in win shares as well at 19.8, which is a crazy high number.
Yeah.
In a season, and led the league in rebounding, of course, too. But yeah, so a dominant season from him.
And the Colonels were 68-16, which was the record in the ABA, the 7.99 SRS, which is also the best in ABA history. Issel, he was third in the league at 30.6 points per game. Dampier was had 36% three-point shooting, which is fourth in the league at 16 points per game. They were just incredibly dominant in the regular season. They hired Joel Mullaney, came in. He had been the coach for the Lakers the previous year. He'd also been a veteran college coach. And Carrier didn't play much this year. This was kind of like the swan song for him. He only played 23 games because of injury. Other notable guys who on the team, Mike Gale in particular, he would make an all defensive team. He was a pretty good defensive guard. And Jimmy O'Brien, who played from 72 to 74. So dominant regular season, but then in the first round they lose to the New York Nets in a pretty shocking upset. Rich and I discussed this quite a bit in our playoff upsets series, so we won't get into necessarily every detail, but the Nets had a 44 wins and a 0.21 SRS, and the Colonels, as we mentioned, the 68 wins and 7.99 SRS, so quite a shocking win. Rick Barry had, you know, one incredible game where he went off in the first game for 50 points, which certainly helped the Nets surprise in game one. And actually, game four, Barry sat out the game with strep throat, and Bill Melchione, their great guard, was injured. But John Roach, another guard, stepped up and 38 points, I believe, and just was able to dribble all around the court and just get shots wherever he wanted them. Completely managed to take the Colonels out of their game. There's one thing that was talked about in Loose Balls where, you know, sort of the defensive philosophy of the Colonels was to allow opposing offensive players into the lane where they would get their shots blocked by Gilmore. And I think Gilmore had something like five blocks per game this season, which is just incredible. He was a very good shot blocker for the rest of his career, but he had nothing like that for the rest of his career. So, you know, but the Nets were able to adjust and kind of figure out that, okay, we're not going to drive to the basket. Instead, we're, you know, just going to take that jumper that's now open, and realize that, you know, in they had the shooters, the guys who could, you know, kind of make those jumpers, and the Colonels had obviously had a hard time adjusting.
Yeah, definitely. And that's interesting. You talk about the defensive system. I was going to touch on later is, yeah, it was very much just a funnel system. I mean, and even they didn't even care if they were allowing middle. I mean, it was just, it's fine. We've got this giant back there that's going to get these blocks. So I don't know how long it took for them to decide on that system. I don't know if it was early in the season, but By the time the playoffs roll around, a little video that we have of these games is I mean, the men guarding the ball handlers, it's pretty atrocious. I mean, it's like just kind of Matador defense. But then, you know, it's all made up for by having Gilmore back there. So that would have been nice to, you know, have when I played to have a guy like that. But no, that was not the case. So no, it's a very different style of play. At times you're just like, what are they doing? But then, you know, Gilmore makes up for it. So yeah, the five blocks a game, that's just an absurd number. And it continued into the playoffs until obviously like you said, the mid-range game just killed them in that series. And, you know, Rick Barry, obviously the main proponent of that.
Yeah. Mid-range game, you know, it's everything's a circle. So, So the 72-73 season, they're still very good, 56-28, second in the league, and they have their first in SRS. They add Rick Mount, who had was an Indiana prep star who had been a bit of a disappointment for the Pacers. He was the first high schooler on Sports Illustrated, first high school basketball player on Sports Illustrated to be on the cover. And but he was a good outside shooter and did fit pretty well in Kentucky. Still didn't quite reach expectations that were expected of him, but he, you know, did better there. And then Wendell Ladner was another addition who more famous probably for the Burt Reynolds-esque poster that was made of him that was sold at the that was a promotion that the Colonels had that was sold out pretty much immediately, but he was a favorite of the ladies. He had it looked a little bit like Burt Reynolds, had the similar mustache and similar look, so they did a similar promotion where he has a basketball strategically placed over his midsection and otherwise is I don't think he's entirely bare, but he's short shorts and otherwise not wearing too much. So
classic ABA there.
Yes, and he also was known very much for being a guy who just had incredible hustle and liked to fight people. So he was he would later be a fairly important part of the 74 Nets championship team, but he was here with the Colonels. He kind of bounced around the league quite a bit, but
Just the fact that a player like that could make it in this league is saying something, kind of where it was at. And, you know, I mean, obviously anyone can kind of question where it stood in terms of the NBA, but imagine even in the 80s, a player like that making it to the league. And I mean, that's kind of his main thing, is he just likes to fight people. You know, that's just like just another one of those things that shows like how different the ABA was.
Yeah. I mean, I think he produced okay. I mean, certainly, you know, he brought some defense and he brought some, you know, some diving from his buzz. I mean, you know, he's like your Dellavedova today. I mean, you know, not that Dellavedova doesn't do some things, but you know, he kind of brings that, you know, sense to the league. I mean, probably the similar type of recklessness that, you know, that Dellavedova is reputed for as well. That's probably a pretty good comparison.
Yeah, no, that's spot on.
Yeah. Thank you. So, you talk about, you know, sort of the Colonels' offensive style. They, you know, with Issel and Gilmore, they become a little bit more of a grinded out team going through the post, while the rest of the league was, you know, more open court, you know, more relying on the fast break and going around, where the, you know, the Colonels had that strength in the middle. You know, Gilmore was by far the best center in the league at this point. Daniels was aging a bit, and some of the other, you know, Beatty was aging a bit as well. And none of those guys had the size that, Gilmore had. So they sort of had a contrast in that way. And this is around the time in which I think the, you know, Dampier's 3-point attempts go down quite a bit too. I mean, he's still effective for 3-point range, but he's not gunning it like he was in the early days of the ABA.
Right, yeah. From the 72 to the 73 season, both their pace and their offensive rating went down, while the defensive rating stayed as the top in the league. So, no, certainly there was a change of focus there. And that clearly had to come from just having Gilmore. It's like you have a guy that dominant in that league at the time. You certainly have to kind of build around that. So, yeah, I think this is the first year we see Dampier not quite be the, you know, star-level player that he was. I mean, I think he continued to make all-star teams based off, you know, kind of just reputation, but
sure.
But you kind of see the drop off from him a little bit.
Mm-hmm. So they beat the Squires in the first round. The Squires had Julius Erving. It was his last of 2 years there. George Gervin, who was a rookie then, who had kind of come on in toward the end of the year. Jim Eakins, who's a solid big man who played for the Squires for most of their time in Virginia. Fatty Taylor and Dave Twardzik would be a key part of the Blazers 77 championship team, kind of a scrappy small guard. And the ease of the series was kind of unexpected. They won 4-1, even though the Squires were 42-42. But they did have Irving, and Irving obviously was even at this point was an incredible star who was known for some big performances. So the fact that there was some dissension there, I think, and that just didn't work out so well. Also, they were pretty young with Irving and Gervin. Then they beat the Carolina Cougars, who were 57-27. They beat them in 7. The Cougars were pretty stacked. They had Billy Cunningham, who had come over from the NBA and was the ABA MVP this year, kind of a do everything forward. Matt Calvin, who was a good small guard. Tom Owens, who was a journeyman but pretty productive, a big man, would also be a part of the late 70s Blazers teams. Joe Caldwell, who had come over from the NBA, was a good player for the Hawks, good kind of up-tempo, fast-break player, kind of a do-everything utility-type player. And while he had sort of created some frustrations with some attitude issues, he definitely could still play. And then Steve Snapper Jones. And they were coached by Larry Brown, who was in his first year of his long coaching career after his ABA playing career. But the Colonels had managed to win the series. The Cougars were down 2-1 as they were able to, but the Cougars were able to win game 4 in Kentucky and then game 5 in Carolina. The 6th game was a rout for the Colonels, so they went back to Carolina. They were of course expected to win at home, but then the Colonels ended up winning quite a bit. They were up by 17 late. The Cougars tried to make a run, but Kentucky was able to win it pretty easily, 107-96.
Yeah, crazy series. And really kind of a marquee series in kind of the ABA's history. The two great teams, tons of talent on both sides. Like you said, Larry Brown being the head coach from one team. It's like this. I did this huge kind of playoff series master list that I'm kind of building, and I'm going to eventually do a bigger project with it. But I went through the ABA as well over the spring, and this was one that scored out very highly, just based on, because I had used different factors, whereas the team's SRS ratings going into it, amount of talent, all-star nods, future Hall of Famers, Hall of Fame coaches if they were involved in. And this one's going to score very, very highly for the ABA. It's kind of one of the marquee series of the entire ABA history. So, yeah, really awesome game. And the 7th game, you kind of wish it would have been maybe a little closer. If we could have some video of it, that'd be one that you kind of go back and really relive. And unfortunately, we just can't. So,
The only game that was really particularly close, looks like at least as far as the final score, was Game 5, which Carolina won by 5. Right. So, all the other ones are, looks like they're about 10 or more. So maybe not, and sometimes, a game will be competitive until 2 minutes left and then one team will pull away. So there may have been, it might have been one of those series where that was enjoyable even despite the scoring margins. But it doesn't look like, based on the final scores, there was necessarily that classic that, you would hope for in this situation.
Right. Yeah. Just in terms of the talent, it's like this could have been one of those, kind of what we had this past year with like an OKC and Golden State thing. And it just didn't quite work out. And the fact that Game 7 was such kind of a lame duck that, that's a shame. But yeah, I mean, obviously huge win for Kentucky. That's kind of, for a franchise that the year before had really failed to live up to their regular season hype, this team finally did do that. And so that was cool to see for sure.
Yeah. And then they reach the finals and they lose in 7 to their rival, the Indiana Pacers. And the Pacers had actually moved west the year previously, and Mike Storen and Dick Tinkham of the Pacers, who were close from the time with the Pacers, kind of hatched the idea of the Pacers moving west because they figured that it would create possible finals matchups between the two cities, which were of course fairly close to each other, and would theoretically create a lucrative situation if they met in the finals. That didn't happen in 72, but in 73 it did happen. The Pacers were able to edge the Colonels out in game 1, despite it being in Louisville. A lot of physical play and controversial calls during the game, including a situation where the Colonels they made a basket, but then it's determined that the 30-second violation had occurred. Pacers managed to win in overtime, 111-107. Kentucky did win game two fairly easily, 114-102. Then won game three in Indianapolis, 92-88 to edge things. The Pacers won a close game in game four, 90-86, and another close game in game five in Kentucky again, 89-86. So they were up 3-2. The Colonels were able to win in Indiana, 109-93 in game four. So a lot of road teams win in this series. And finally, Game 7, we're in Kentucky, and another game on the road. The Pacers won all three of their championships on the road, interestingly enough. George McGinnis was incredible during this postseason, 22.3 points, 13.7 rebounds against the Colonels, and 27 in the final 88-81 game, kind of a slowdown game. Actually, quite a few low-scoring games in this series. You know, you're used to the ABA kind of being more fast-paced, and that isn't necessarily the case here.
Right, yeah. I mean, that three-game stretch in the middle, games 3, 4, and 5, neither team even breaks 93. So that's a very bizarre thing for the ABA. And, yeah, I mean, game 6 is really the only one where one of the teams kind of goes out, I guess, too, as well. But
even during that time, the NBA, that would have been rare in the NBA. I mean, ABA was considered the fast-paced league. The NBA was still, not as fast as it was in the 60s, but certainly faster than it is today.
Right, high pace, yeah, many possessions and bad shooting, so yes. plenty of opportunities for extra rebounds, extra points. So, exactly. The road thing has always been strange to me, because I was noticing that too, how, the road team won a bunch of games in all of Kentucky's runs, and I don't know if that was a case of the officiating was different or all these arenas that they're playing in. I mean, Kentucky by the end had about 8,000 people once they moved to Freedom Hall. That was kind of like their average attendance, and that was considered very good for the ABA. So maybe it's just the fact that there's quite, isn't as many people. I don't know. I'm trying to just theorize something as to why there didn't seem to be as much of a home court advantage in the ABA as there is now, obviously. Yeah. Or even, in the 80s or 90s. And it's just kind of a strange thing that happened during that stretch of basketball history, really.
Yeah, I haven't looked at it deeply, but from what I recall, like in the early days in the NBA, like 50s and 60s, home court advantage was a, more teams won games at home during those times than do now. And that's steadily sort of decreased. I don't know exactly what it was in the 70s or in the ABA. In this series, obviously Louisville and Indianapolis are not that far from each other. So you might have some traveling, and you also might have some you're not having to have long flights. You're able to, I don't know if they stayed, where they stayed in the hotels, but even if they stayed on the road at those cities, you're still not having, something if it had happened, if it had been in Los Angeles or whatever, So that I'm sure that makes somewhat of a difference as far as the series goes. But as far as like that overall trend, yeah, that's interesting. I don't know where I don't know if anybody's looked at that or not, but that's an interesting observation.
Right. And as I'm just looking at this from just in terms of the playoffs. I mean, I haven't, just like I said, I was doing that massive playoff kind of study that I've been doing. And yeah, it's just a weird time where in the playoffs in particular, there's a lot of upsets in big games. And ones you would think, okay, these games, 5 or 6 would really matter to this home team. And they seem to drop it. It's just kind of an odd occurrence during that stretch. And again, it occurred in this series.
Yeah. So 73-74 season, the Colonels are 53-31, second in the league in SRS, 3.71, so less impressive than it's been the last few seasons. The John Y. Brown purchased the interest of the previous owner, Wendell Cherry, in between these two seasons, helped to keep the team from moving to Cincinnati, where obviously it was a bigger city. The Royals had just moved out of Cincinnati, so they had a chance to move into that market that had been established NBA market, even though it obviously had failed there, but was a bigger city than Louisville, and I guess you had a chance there. John Y. Brown, controversial owner of the 1970s, to put it mildly, he put his wife Ellie and a 10-woman board of directors in charge of the team, which Mike Storin, the GM, did not like. Thought that it was a sign that he was going to run the team his way, and decided to leave the team as a result. And then 2 months later, actually became the ABA commissioner. So. And then Joe Mullaney, the coach, decided to leave as well, figuring that there were some ideas that Brown had that he just thought this stuff doesn't make sense. I'm sure there was some sexism at play with the board of directors as well, although they at the very least seemed to you know, the moves that the team made over the next few seasons seemed to be fairly smart, sound moves. So it didn't really necessarily hurt the decision making there. And they were able to launch a effective ticket selling campaign, reportedly tripling ticket season ticket sales for the next season and doubling overall attendance. So and it got some publicity. There's a People magazine feature from 75 on both the Browns, talking about Ellie Brown and talking about some of the decisions that they made, some of the promotional stuff, and feeling like that, you know, that they do make a lot of decisions, and the players seem to, you know, they had some good, seemed to have a good relationship with Ellie and with the group, and were willing to sit down with her. So, it seemed to work out fairly well, despite, you know, maybe seeming like an absurd idea at the time.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, if you can imagine if this happened now, where there's a female owner and an all female board, in like, you know, not as sexist as it was then, society that we have now, it'd be an uproar. You can imagine in 73, that was obviously a huge deal. And yeah, I mean, there's like a little retrospective that you can find on YouTube where there's kind of like a video of a bunch of the principals from the 1975 team talking about that season and everything. And they have all great things to say about Ellie Brown. So it doesn't seem like, you know, it seemed like it was a success almost all the way around, other than just a few kind of older white men being angry at the situation in general. It seemed like it worked. And Hubie Brown, especially, obviously no relation to the Browns, but it just loved her and just talked about how her kind of steady hand just like really helped the whole franchise and set the tone, you know, from the top down. So it was pretty cool that was allowed to happen and that it worked.
Yeah. Legendary Kentucky coach and even more famous racist Adolph Rupp is hired as vice president of the board. It was 6 minutes after he'd left a similar position in Memphis and decried the ABA as a bush league. So he liked the money. Babe McCarthy took over as coach in 74. He's known as Magnolia Mouth and was spent 7 years in the ABA, was ABA Coach of the Year twice and coached in 3 All-Star games. He'd also coached for New Orleans and Memphis when they moved there, and was known for his babisms. Some of those phrases include, you got to come at him like a biting sow, and why panic at 5 in the morning because it's still dark out, and my favorite one, now let's cloud up and rain all over him. So those are better in a Southern accent, which I don't want to, you know, I don't want to make anybody mad by trying a Southern accent. So he also was notorious for hating what he called pissant guards, who were like the very small guards, and he absolutely hated like guys like Larry Brown and, you know, the guys, you met Matt Calvin, the guy, he didn't want any of those guys in his teams. He wanted larger guards for whatever reason. He had a bias against very small guards. So
yeah, there's a little stretch in Loose Balls about that. They used the word pissant about 5 times, and, you know, 2-page stretch about how much he hated those. Really, really, I mean, the lack of like foresight to see kind of where the leak was going is startling for sure. But yeah, no, he seemed like not the most pleasant guy to be around.
Well, yeah, I don't know.
I mean, I guess it depends on your personality. But
yeah, I think most people actually did like him. He was just like, he was kooky, you know, and he, I mean, he did things like if a player was sad, he would suddenly like, he would go away for a while and then he would show up and bring some ladies to practice to like comfort them. And like, he would, you know, everyone would like head to the gym and he would about to go in and he's like, oops, I forgot the key. Let's call it off today, guys. You know, he was just like he was kind of a character. I think most people liked playing for him. I got the sense more that he was while he may have, you know, been angry sometimes, he was generally a guy that people enjoyed playing for. So so a major move that they made, they added a John Roach, who had burned them so much in that Nets series in 72. He was a midseason trade for Gail and Ladner, and actually he ended up being shipped out not that much longer after in the People magazine feature, Ellie Brown mentioned that, you know, that was like the one time where, you know, when she was unable to resolve personality between him and her coach, she traded the player, you know, was sort of one of the things that was brought up as far as her dealing with the players directly and, you know, making important decisions. So during the season, Gilmore, he had 40 rebounds against the Nets, and I believe that set an ABA record. They ended up beating the Cougars much easier this time. In they swept them in the East semis and then lost to the Nets. Were swept by the Nets in the East finals. The Nets would win the championship this year with Dr. J, so they faced Dr. J again in this series. The Nets also have Larry Keenan, Brian Taylor, Billy Paltz, Super John Williamson, and Mike Gale and Wendell Ladner, who they of course had traded for Roche with the Nets. So and that ended up obviously playing poorly. The key moment of this series was in Game 3. Irving hit a fall-away bank shot at the buzzer to win the game for the Nets and to give the Nets, of course, a 3-0 series lead. And McCarthy was actually named co-coach of the year with Joe Mullaney, who had gone to Utah, the previous Colonels coach. But then, because after the second round loss, he was fired. And then, unfortunately, he died of colon cancer in March of 1975, so less than a year later.
Yeah, really sad. Yeah, I kind of read a little bit about that myself, and kind of awful. Like, what a terrible turn, you know, just a year of the last year of that man's life. Or really just a bummer. But no, that 74 season was definitely, it was the low in terms of SRS of that four, of that great kind of 5-year run. They dropped, that was the one year they did drop from first in defensive rating to second. It just kind of seemed like it didn't totally mesh that year, and then obviously culminated in that second round flameout, or I guess semifinal flameout. Gilmore again led the league in rebounding and all-star, you know, was an all-star again. Dan Pierre was an all-star again. Dan Issel was an all-star again. So, you know, all the pieces were there for them to be great again. But the second round, again, the irony of them making that trade, thinking that would help them out, and then getting burned by the very team that they were trying to beat with that trade. Yeah, not a great look. So you can understand maybe why, you know, McCarthy would get the axe after that season.
Yeah, and, you know, John White Brown was known for his lack of patience, or would become kind of known for that. He's still obviously early as an owner. 75 though, Huey Brown is hired as coach, and he had gained a reputation as an assistant in Milwaukee just with his detail oriented, his preparation. And he impressed the Colonels with his interview with just being able to size the team up, and also his ability to actually ask questions of the team, and really as the team interviewing for him as much as he was interviewing for the team, understood of a situation that was championship or bust. Stan Albeck, later head coach in the ABA and NBA, would become Huey's assistant and would bring a lot of ABA experience, and they had a kind of a good mesh of personalities because Brown was very intense and Albeck was more laid back. Huey also, in Loose Balls, gets into this, talking about like understanding, like, you know, things that we kind of consider advanced stats concepts, like point differential, that, you know, really, you know, was not something that was talked about in the NBA landscape at large, you know, really up until maybe like 10 years ago. He was talking about in the 70s and did lots of charting, lots of stats, lots of like, you know, stats that we kind of take for granted today, he was sort of using in the 70s, so that was kind of interesting. He also tried to use 10 guys instead of 8 because he felt like if you played 10 guys, you could keep your whole team happy because you only really have a dissension in the last couple players, and those are usually marginal guys, and it wasn't going to, you know, necessarily spread throughout the locker room. He also called Louis Dampier the best clutch player he'd ever seen and tried to give him the ball when the game was on the line. Also tried to increase Gilmore's workload on offense, taking away some shots from Issel, which, you know, he's tried to smooth that over, but everyone, it worked obviously with their success. He was also very serious about practice and also was a known cursor. There's a story about a game which was sparsely attended. There was his cursing was going out over the radio, and his wife called during halftime. You can hear him over the radio. Can't you do anything about this? And I thought that was a pretty funny story.
Yeah, he clearly had a mouth on him. And back in the ABA, obviously, that's going to be much more like that to happen. It's not like there's an 18,000 seat stadium that's sold out where you can't, you know, everything's drowned out by the noise. No, hilarious. But yeah, back to Huey. There's a little section in Loose Balls about him actually drawing up plays for three-pointers, which was just unheard of. If you watch games from back then, there's no, like, guys coming off pin downs, like, coming off curls for threes. It's like, that's just didn't happen. It wasn't even in people's playbooks. But Huey actually would draw those up for Dampier.
He even talked about Dampier, like, being okay with him taking a three off, you know, like, on the fast break. Open, which looks like, wow, that's, you know, because people even, up until Steph Curry, people even kind of, you were like, no, you don't never do that. And that, you know, it's like the last, I think, 3 or 4 years where that's the orthodoxy on that has changed, even in the NBA.
Right. And even still, you know, there's coaches that I'm around that think that's just like an absolute no-no. And you have a guy who, you know, 40 years ago was allowing that in the ABA. That's pretty cool, honestly. And you know, just kind of shows his foresight that this is where the league was going. And you use something that's worth one more point. You know, it seems like simple math to us now, but at the time it was just very much rejected. So it's cool to see that he actually used that.
Yeah, absolutely. So they do change around their bench quite a bit. They add a lot of ABA veterans, Gene Littles, Marv Roberts, Ted McLean, Bert Everett, who was a young player, and Will Jones. Will Jones actually was John Y. Brown's idea. He tried to figure out who the guy who played Irving the toughest, and Will Jones was the guy who they decided to pick up. So they ended up picking him up, and although he didn't really matter because they didn't really need him for – well, I guess it did matter a little bit. Because we'll explain why in just a moment. Interestingly enough, it's a very top-heavy league this season. Like, there are three teams, including the Colonels, who have, like, an over 6 SRS. And then there's a bunch of teams, like, kind of at the bottom during this time. And this is, you know, the 75 is the second to last season for the ABA. So, you know, it's increasingly stratifying with the, you know, the poor teams like San Diego and Virginia are really shrinking. And obviously the strong teams, the Colonels and the Nets are doing much better.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like, yeah, they're very much fortifying their rosters, and it's becoming, you know, there's zero middle class. And yeah, to see them have a 6.24 SRS, which is not that much lower than their 72 season when they had 7.99, and that'd be third in the league, that was shocking.
Right.
It kind of, I had to go look at that and be like, oh, wow, that's, you know, there were three teams that were really legit teams that year. Obviously, they went 58-26, and were, again, first in defensive rating. So you can, you know, thank Gilmore and Hubie Brown's coaching for that.
Sure. So they were, for most of the season, they were in second place in the East, but behind the Nets. But then they won 22 out of their last 25 games, including 10 in a row to close the regular season. They had a 16-point differential during that stretch. And then they ended up beating the Nets in a tiebreaker to win the division. They were four games behind the Nets with seven to go. I believe they beat them three times during that stretch, and then were able to, you know, then they had the one game playoff victory. And then they ended up playing the Memphis Sounds in the first game, and the Memphis Sounds were 27-57. So the fact that they made the playoffs shows you the state of the league at the time. The Sounds had Tom Owens, George Carter, and Mel Daniels at the very, very end of his, or near the very end of his career. And then because as Rich and I talked about in our playoff upsets show, the Spirits of St. Louis have the greatest upset in pro basketball history, playoff upset, by beating the Nets in the first round. So the fact that the Colonels actually were able to, you know, catch the Nets forced that upset to happen, and then they got a easier shot at beating the Spirits. Although the Spirits actually, they did give it a bit of a, you know, those games were fairly competitive, and the fact that Freddie Lewis got hurt, I believe, in game three of that series. You know, the Spirits had a chance to come back and make it tough, but once Lewis was hurt, they didn't really have anything else. They had Marvin Barnes and Maurice Lucas. They had young talent, but, you know, had a difficult time harnessing it without Lewis on there, who was kind of the steady veteran who had, you know, led Indiana to a lot of championships.
Right, right. And that game against the Nets is one of those, yeah, it's just a huge, huge game. And I don't know, when I was doing my research on this, I don't know if you found this. Do you know why Louisville got to play, or why Kentucky got to play that game in Louisville?
I don't know. It might have just been a coin flip. Yeah, I didn't look that up. Did they win the regular season series? That would be the only other thing that I would think would be a factor.
I didn't actually check that. But yeah, no, I was thinking that, I mean, for such a huge, huge game, it was interesting that, you know, Kentucky got to host that game. It's like, well, if they're going to get to host it, why don't you just give them the tiebreaker now? You know, if that's like, I don't know, why would that, you know, if anything,
that's an interesting question. Yeah, I don't know the answer to that. Perhaps someone listening will let us know if they know the answer to that. So
yeah, but no, like you said, that changed kind of the whole playoff structure. And then the Spirits pulling off that upset, it's like, to me, it reminded me of 2007 when Golden State beats Dallas, and that really opens the door for San Antonio to now become kind of the class of the West, and really, you know, ended up with a title just like it did for Kentucky this year.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, Kentucky beat a 27-win team in the playoffs, and the 32-win team in the playoffs, and then in the finals, beat the Pacers, who had a pretty big upset of their own to make it to the ABA Finals. They were only 45-39. They had upset a heavily favored Denver team, who had like a 20 games better a team, another one of the big upsets of the 70s, talked about on that episode as well. And this was the Pacers still had George McGinnis, they still had Darnell Hillman and Billy Keller and Roger Brown very much on the bench at that point, but they'd added Billy Knight and Kevin Joyce. And the Colonels were able to win this series 4-1, avenging their 73 finals loss. And Gilmore dominant, 25 points per game, 21 rebounds per game, 1.2 blocks per game. McGinnis also very good. He had 27.4 points per game, 14 rebounds per game, and 6.4 assists, although his playoff averages were 32.3, 15.9, and 8.2. So incredible playoff run for him. Colonels won a blowout 102-94 in game one. Game two was closer. Score was tied with 12 to go, but then they went inside to Gilmore, who put the Colonels up by two with a close range shot. And then Billy Keller actually managed to hit a three-pointer at the buzzer for Indiana, but then after a few minutes of deliberation, the referees ruled that it had come too late, and the Colonels won the series, and that was pretty much the the last games were all fairly close, but there was after that the Pacers didn't really seem to have a shot. They lost game four in Indiana 94-86, but the other ones they took handily, and in game five they won 110-105, and Gilmore won the playoff MVP award during the series.
Yeah, again, I love that ABA had the playoff MVP, not just the finals MVP. That's a little plus in their column. But yeah, really cool that they got to win that game at home after years of being really good and right there and just never being able to get over the hump. Cool that Louisville got to experience the championship at home.
Yes.
Kind of awesome for them.
They celebrate by throwing Ellie Brown in the shower. That it's a tradition that they throw the owner in the shower. So they threw her in the shower, and Hugh Brown had the word pressure engraved on their championship rings, with the idea that because they played so much under pressure. But it's interesting. They just had such a. I mean, they happened to win the championship this year, but they had such a. They were able to. They were very lucky in who they faced as far as like the.
Oh, definitely.
The two top tier teams. Both of them were upset early on in the play. Denver and the Nets. So they were able to kind of. They had some luck in winning this championship. But hey, you can only face who you're facing, and they won those games. So kudos to them.
Right, I'm sure in 72 they would argue it's lucky that that nobody had to face them.
Yeah,
because they got blown out the first round. So.
Yeah, that's absolutely a fair point. So 76, we'll just go through that a little bit briefly. They falter a bit. They're 46-38, fourth out of seven teams in the league. The several teams have folded at this point. Fourth in the league in SRS. Dan Issel was sold before the 76 seasons, first going to the Baltimore Claws, who never actually – they were the Memphis franchise, but they never actually ended up playing a game in Baltimore. They the team is folded during the preseason after the owners don't have any money. Issel eventually goes to the Nuggets. And John White Brown is criticized heavily for this, but basically he said, we lost $500,000 a year. I need to do this. I saved the franchise and my moves brought us a championship while you're criticizing me, and sort of was the end of the honeymoon for Brown in Louisville. They did manage to get Maurice Lucas. They had Caldwell Jones briefly after San Diego folded, then they traded him for Maurice Lucas, and it was a good player on the court for him, but led to a really infamous confrontation between Lucas and Hubie Brown. And I've heard it told several ways, but basically the story is that Hubie is either yelling at Artis Gilmore or he's yelling directly at Lucas, and Lucas gets in Hubie's face and points his fingers like, hey, you don't shout at me like this, or you don't shout at him like this. And then Hubie yells at him and tells him to, Hubie was known for his temper during that time. And there's, an article written like in 1979 or 80 when he's coach of the Hawks, where he has some views on black players that are less than enlightened. And, maybe he's changed since then. And, he's obviously, great basketball mind and, incredible coach and, comes off as a decent person, at least in his commentary. So it's hard to know what's in his heart, but he certainly had his issues during this time. And not only that, but he and Huey Brown and John Y. Brown also clashed quite a bit with the way that John Y. Brown was running the team. And so there are a lot of tumultuous stuff going on during the season. But by the end of the season, the team is playing well. They thought they had not a chance to defend the title. They beat the Pacers in a mini series in the first round, 2-1. But then they lose to the Denver team, where they had traded Dan Issel, who had been a powerhouse the year before, and then reshaped themselves even more with Issel and David Thompson. Also had Bobby Jones, Byron Beck, and Ralph Simpson, really just a powerhouse team that year, and lost to them in the semifinals.
Yeah, right. That Denver team is just awesome. Loaded. Kind of shocking that Kentucky even took them to seven. Really just, yeah, very good on Kentucky for even doing that. But no, it's pretty clear that Lucas and Brown are just not fans of each other. And just kind of an unfortunate situation after the year before, you know, every player on the team, both in the stuff I've read and that kind of retrospective on the 75 championship team, just loved UB. Talked about how great the chemistry was between the coaching staff and the players, and really seemed to enjoy the season. And it just seemed like, both with, you know, 76 winding down, it seemed like the merger was obviously coming and teams folding. It's just Kentucky also, as with the rest of the league, it just kind of petered out. And, you know, a bit unfortunate to have that be your title defense season, but, you know, that was the nature of the ABA.
Yeah. So, unfortunately, the leagues merge and fans in Kentucky no longer have a team. John Y. Brown accepted $3 million to fold the team rather than paying $3.2 million to join the NBA, which, you know, made sense as a financial decision, but he further, you know, angered the fans, obviously. John Y. Said that he later would say that Ellie and I decided that basketball is not the kind of business we want to be in. But then, not long afterward, he would buy the Buffalo Braves for $1.5 million. So, kind of an odd decision there. Interestingly enough, he would make some big moves for Buffalo, which we talked about John Y. Brown in our craziest owners story, but some details that I didn't know at the time that I wanted to share here, since we don't really have a good opportunity to do that. After they had traded Bob McAdoo to the Knicks, which had been done sort of under right when they're transitioning ownership, and it was more of a Paul Snyder, the previous owner's decision, than John Y. Brown's, he ended up re-signing Randy Smith, their all-star guard, then trading the team's first-round pick to the Bucks for Sven Nader, who had been picked up as a free agent from the ABA. And then in a single day, he made two significant trades. One was trading Adrian Dantley, who was the rookie of the year, to the Pacers for Billy Knight, who was second in the league in scoring the previous season. And then 4 hours later, he acquired a Tiny Archibald from the Nets for George Johnson and a first-round pick in 1979. And then would eventually gain a full share of the team from Snyder. And then the following year, which we've gone through, swap franchises with the Celtics, Irv Levin, and the Braves then became the Clippers and moved to San Diego, and John Brown took control of the Celtics. But eventually he clashed with Red Auerbach so much, making moves without consulting him, including trading three first-round picks for Bob McAdoo, that eventually Auerbach threatened to leave to become president of the Knicks if the co-owner Harry Mangurian didn't get rid of John Y. Brown. And eventually Brown sold the interest of the team to him, and he left pro basketball in 1979. And actually, he and Ellie got divorced in 1977. Then he went to run for governor and married former Miss America CBS sportscaster Phyllis George, and then became governor of Kentucky. So,
yeah. A wild career for that guy. And obviously, you know, earlier in his career, he was the KFC guy.
I didn't even mention that. Yeah, so
yeah,
I feel like I've spent so much time on John Y. Brown in this spot. In this entire series, I didn't plan to do that, but he did a lot of things, so he's an interesting guy.
No, definitely. It sounds like when you read it off like that, and just how short a span that was that he did all of that. It's like a kid playing 2K on like my GM and just like flipping franchises like it's nothing, you know, every other year.
And not even getting into the details of the Clippers Celtics swap, which is just a whole other thing, you know.
Right. Yeah.
And, and Tiny Archibald got hurt, like he tore his ACL like he didn't even play for the. For the Braves because of that. So, and then was traded to the Celtics actually, and then did pretty well with the Celtics, but you know, he went through a lot through that as well and got traded twice by John Y. Brown. So just, just a lot of random stuff going on during that time.
Yeah.
And this is, you know, all this is kind of like right in the first few years of free agency, the limited free agency that it was. And that kind of just changed the shape of things in the league too. It's I think adding another element to what's already kind of unstable league with all the, you know, the franchises being added and franchises moving and, you know, everything that we've gone through in previous episodes.
Yeah, no, certainly a completely different time than it is now.
Yes. So anything else you want to get into?
Yeah, I mean, I think kind of tying together the Cardinals, I mean, it really is an amazing franchise. And for the 9 years that they were in existence, they had the most wins of any other ABA team, regular season wins, and second most playoff wins. Again, only that one losing season, the very first season. And I think it's a shame that, you know, I've been fortunate enough to kind of travel around the country, you know, through different things and go to almost half the league's arenas at this point. And one of the things I love to do is I look up at the banners and you see, you know, championship banners, you know, retired numbers, all those things. And, you know, some arenas have, like, you know, the trophies out and at some point, you know, on the concourse level. And it's a shame that Kentucky didn't even move somewhere else where it's like they didn't become the Clippers or, you know, they didn't become something else where at least you can have some of that history. There's just nowhere you can see it because it's an impressive history. And it's just a shame that we don't have that anymore, because that's, you know, one of my most fun things about going to new arenas. And yeah, we just can't even get that. There's nowhere for, you know, there's no team that's going to play Colonel's highlight packages before the intros. You know, it's just done. There's just kind of nowhere for them to go. So that's a real shame for a franchise that really kind of deserves that.
It's tough when there's really no place that kind of keeps that legacy alive. That's a hard thing. I mean, there've been books on the Colonels, and there've been other things, obviously websites and things that are, you know, keeping the Hips history alive, but it's different from actually having a vehicle, you know, a team that kind of is able to promote your history. I mean, there's no, obviously there's not a pro team in Kentucky or near Kentucky. So other than the Pacers, who of course were a rival of Kentucky and probably aren't, you know, even if they were interested in promoting that history, that it's unlikely they were going to be doing that. So yeah, it's just one of those things. But yeah, I'm glad we got a good chance to go through their history, because I think they are a fascinating team and, you know, quite an accomplished team. One of the more accomplished teams of the 70s. You know, certainly in the conversation for one of the, you know, the most accomplished teams of that decade.
Absolutely, yeah, no question about it.
All right, well, thanks everyone for checking us out. You can find us at harvardprocessism.com and check out Adam's work at basketballpantheon.com. Some great stuff going on there. You can find us on Twitter and Facebook at Over and Back NBA. And you can also find us on iTunes and Stitcher. If you want to leave us a rating and review, we'd greatly appreciate that. Or wherever you listen to podcasts, you can probably do it there too. So until next time, we'll be back again soon.